Welcome to the Native Advertising Powerhouse, a podcast dedicated to help publishers and native ad studio professionals build a solid framework for their native advertising efforts. The host of the show is Jesper Lawson, founder of the Native Advertising Institute.
My name is Jesper Lawson, and you're listening to the sixth episode of the Native Advertising Powerhouse. Today, I have David Landis joining me on the show. David is content director at Tail Content Creators and former head of commercial content at The Local. He'll also be moderating a panel discussion at our conference, Native Advertising Days, in Berlin this November. So without further ado, welcome on the show, David.
Thank you so much, Jesper. Great to be here.
You have a background both in the editorial side of the business, and now you're working at a content agency. Could you share with us a little bit about your background and what got you to the point where you are today?
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess the bulk of my career was on the editorial side at The Local, a digital publisher based in Stockholm, where I moved about a dozen years ago. And I started there in the newsroom working as a journalist and eventually rose to be editor of the Swedish site of The Local's network. And that was a great experience, and I really got a chance to tell stories to the rest of the world about Sweden. And interestingly enough, I'd say The Local was a bit ahead of the curve when it comes to native advertising. And when I was on the editorial desk, we had a small part of the sales team that was working with freelancers to do the occasional sponsored article. And I remember the very first sponsored article we wrote, this was back in 2010, 2011, was quite controversial. And some of the trade press here in Sweden thought that this was a very dangerous precedent. But we pressed ahead, and we found that some of the advertisers and more advertisers thought this was a useful format. And in 2014, I was asked to help actually codify this kind of roughshod operation into a proper studio. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the shift from the editorial side to the business side was a bit of a challenge, but also really exciting. I'd been with the company for a while, so I was looking forward to new challenges. And I found there was a part of me that really enjoyed the cooperative aspect of working in a commercial environment. When you're on the news desk, it's very adversarial.
Right.
You're sort of sparring with your interview subjects, and they're trying to get the story to be one way, and you're trying to find the other story, the truth. And it's exciting but exhausting. And I think it's much more rewarding for me personally to be able to work together and sit down with clients and say, okay, how can we work together to best tell your story?
Okay. And working together with them on that, are they willing to tell stories, or are they more into selling commercial messages?
It's a bit of a balance. And I think, you know, I found this both while I was at The Local building up the client studio there, and now in my new role at Tail. You know, now I'm at an independent content agency. And what I think I've found is there's a real range of, say, maturity in storytelling among different clients. And there are, and you can almost tell when you start the conversation if you're talking to someone who understands the power of storytelling and how it can help the business, as opposed to someone who is kind of schooled in an old way of thinking about communications and marketing. Mm-hmm. So that becomes a part of, I think, my sales approach, and is sort of hearing, well, where is the client in their journey, and how can I help them move forward? Because not everyone is equipped. I mean, it's A, recognizing the value, but also then recognizing what it takes to actually tell good stories, and that, you know, not every client is set up to do that.
You've been living in Sweden for a while, but you're American. But how do you see the maturity level of the industry in Sweden, the native advertising industry?
I think that it's come along pretty far. I do sense that there is, I mean, the U.S. market is much bigger. There's a lot more money. And so in some senses, the U.S. is, you know, really leading on the leading edge of a lot of things. But I look at at how things have evolved here in Sweden and feel that, you know, there are some really advanced players. There's, you know, we've got two very huge publishing houses here in the Bonnier, and then Schibsted is quite active, and they've really been front runners in trying to be big players in the native space. But a lot of niche publishers are also getting into the game. And I think, you know, my experience at the local, we are a bit of a hybrid in that we are global in our reach, but also quite niche in our audience. Mm. And so there is, I think, a different approach that you need to think about if you're a niche publisher, as opposed to a large publishing house, which has a lot of different titles and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, I've also seen a lot of development in the sort of marriage of tech and native here. There are some interesting platform companies trying to help automate and bring native across multiple platforms. But it's still, I mean, it's an evolution by all means.
We're in the process of judging the entries for the 2018 Native Advertising Awards, and there's a lot of submissions from Sweden, a lot of really, really good projects, as well as studios competing. So there's a lot of good stuff going on in Sweden.
Well, I you know, in my first visit to Native Advertising Days last year in Berlin, I was a bit struck by a number of Swedish entrants. I mean, the number of Swedes who were there, and again, I think perhaps the Native Advertising Institute's home base in Copenhagen gives there a little bit of a Nordic edge, or it feels a bit more attainable. But I think, you know, native is, you know, I could make a theorize that something about native advertising really hits at the heart of the way Swedes want to communicate. Swedes are innovative in technology. I mean, they've, you know, there is a sense of design and creativity, and native, I think, allows a lot of those elements to come together. Mm. So you can bring a lot of those capacities to bear. And then there's a lot of large brands and companies in Sweden who are probably have the wherewithal and the need to up their game when it comes to storytelling and content marketing. Mm.
I think it's going to keep evolving, you know, in every market. I saw recently a study, I think it was from eMarketer, that showed that in a year or two, more than half of all the advertising is going to be native. You can never tell, obviously, with these kind of predictions, but I think it's fair to say that the budget situation is still that more and more money is put into native advertising on a global scale.
No, I think you're absolutely right that I think native, while it's matured in many ways, is still in the growth phase. And, you know, it really, in many ways, is a bit of a paradigm shift. And it takes a while for these kind of things to shake out. Mm-hmm. And certainly, it's not surprising that digital publishing is leading the way. I mean, it's a bit of a consequence or an effect of the overall disruption that the digital publishing brought into the publishing world, and how to monetize and how to best leverage these channels. And I think there's an increasing recognition that the way in which publishers first thought that they would monetize through traditional banner ads is not sufficient. So one, I mean, with the automation there, prices came down, so that put a lot of price pressure on. Secondly, I think you just have an increasingly savvy and very cynical audience. People don't want to waste time and don't want to have their experience interrupted by things that they're not interested in. So there's a lot of this is, I think, audience driven and realizing that, hey, if we use our platforms and shape the message of our clients into a format and an angle that is relevant, we can have a much better effect. It's a very different relationship, I think, both between the brand and publisher, but also between the reader and the brand. Mm. You open up a totally different type of conversation, which is really exciting, I think, and opens up a whole new world of possibilities.
But at the same time, there is a lot of pushback on native advertising. You said yourself that the first piece you did at the local got pushback from trade publications. How do you feel about the people who are saying that you're cheating the readers, or that gives pushback to native?
No, I guess this debate is going to keep going for a little while. From where I sit, I think I've been involved with native now for a number of years. And personally, I think that native done well actually does a service to readers. And when I mean done well, I mean that the content is engaging and relevant. The labeling is clear. There's no question that the advertiser or brand was tied to it. I think I'm surprised still that that has, there's still debate about that, because I think if you are clear and transparent about your relationship, that the whole point is you want brand association. And so I think that people who are suspicious of native because of they were sort of sneak in and make people read articles that are sponsored and make it look like it's not sponsored. I think they've just unfortunately perhaps consumed what I would call subpar native advertising. I mean, the whole point is to put the brand, I mean, where native is most effective, I think, is in helping define a brand, raise awareness for a brand, and help an audience really understand that brand story, that brand message. And I mean, I can kind of turn it on its head and say, a lot of the things that you read in the newspaper, there's a quote from someone, there's a study that's referred to, often which also have brand associations. And what is not at all clear to the reader is how much money brands have invested to make sure that it is their study that gets referred to, or it is their expert that gets called. And so I used to sort of joke that the division between earned media and paid media is a bit of a false dichotomy, because there's a lot of money spent on earned media as well. It's just that someone else gets paid, not the publisher. And so from a brand perspective, that I think PR has a role to play. I don't think that it's dishonest to have your study referred to, so to speak. I mean, you know, but the reader doesn't necessarily have that same connection or get the same impression of how the brand relates to this content. And this has become much more apparent to me now on the agency side, where I am working a bit more cross-functionally. Tail Content is a new started agency within a broader communications group of communications companies. So we have partner companies that work in branding, digital agency, and public relations and corporate communications. And so I'm seeing how all these parts fit together. And our approach is, I mean, I'm a journalist. The CEO is a journalist. We want to help brands think and act and communicate like publishers.
Okay.
And we see that as the model by which you can best leverage all of these different tracks. Whereas before, you had the marketing department over here, you had your kind of public relations people over here, you had your media people, you can throw in internal communications, HR, all of those were quite siloed and still are in many organizations. But where the magic happens and what has to happen is there's a convergence. And these different places have to start talking to each other and working to put their message together. And that's part of what we're doing now. And native is a big part of that because that provides our clients with a special kind of channel to reach out both to the market more broadly, but also to decision makers. I mean, native in public affairs and sort of helping shape public opinion is a really interesting tool that wasn't there before. There's a lot going on, that's for sure.
So at Tail, you do, if you go to your website, it says that you do content marketing. Now, for those of our listeners who are a little not certain about the definitions, content marketing would be more where the at the core of the project would be to build an owned audience on your own platforms, whereas native advertising takes place, I mean, the actual activity mainly takes place on somebody else's platform. There seems to be kind of two main reasons for going into native. One would be as a replacement for your traditional advertising. So if you find that the audience don't respond to your ads the way they used to do, you start working with storytelling, and then you find that they'll react differently and oftentimes better to those, and then you'll replace your ads with that, but it's still like very campaign based and isolated on other people's platform. And then there's the second route into native advertising, which is having paid distribution as part of your content marketing efforts. And I guess that's what you're working with at Tail.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, I think native is particularly interesting because it does allow your story to appear in other platforms and meet the audience where the audience already is and give them something that they find valuable. And how that fits into the overall strategy, it depends. In some cases, it's a very specific kind of conversion-related goal that you have an article that you hope people then will click back to your website and download a white paper or purchase something. Mm. In some other cases, it's a bit more diffuse. It's really about raising awareness and just kind of making sure that the audience is I'd call it sort of building an impression so that over time, a long native campaign can kind of help position a brand in a certain area. Let's say that it's a topic like sustainability or something, and you want to have your company more positioned near sustainability. You can tell sustainability stories. Mm. And I mean, I think this is what we really try to push from Tail's perspective, is to have a sort of a channel neutral approach. I mean, your channel, your website is one of many possible places where a story can be seen and shaped, and native is another. And so by allowing people, the reality is most people don't spend time on corporate websites. Mm. Most people spend time on platforms like social media or different newspapers, publishers. That's where they're consuming a lot of content. So that's where you need to go where the audience is. Mm. And the trick, I think, is finding stories that are both appropriate for the audiences that you're trying to reach, but that also help you as a brand and as a company strengthen your business and marketing goals wherever you want to take the company. And so that's, I think, a challenge, is bringing those two things together and, you know, knowing, all right, who's in charge? Is it the audience that's in charge, or is it the brand that's in charge of that conversation?
But it's interesting, the whole point of being channel neutral, which makes sense in many ways. On the other hand, you'll have people, especially from the publisher's side, who are saying that some use the term true native, as in something that is really, really tailor-made for that specific publication or online platform, and, you know, in essence, can't really be used on other platforms. So at one end of the spectrum, you have someone saying this story is crafted for this particular newspaper, it can't be used anywhere else, and if it were to be used elsewhere, it would be kind of an alien element. And the problem with that is obviously like scalability. So if you create something for one publication, you can't use it elsewhere. Now, on the other hand, is what you're talking about is channel neutrality. So how do you see those two together? I mean, can you take the same piece of content and distribute it on a wide range of channels without it being non-native?
It's a tricky question, and I think, you know, I think my thinking has certainly evolved on this as my own career has evolved, and certainly at the local, I mean, we did true native, and for me, native by any other name isn't native, and it was paramount for us at that time to make sure that everything that we put up felt natural on the local channel. Now, that is easier said than done. A lot of times clients had very specific ideas about what they wanted to do. And so there was a bit of negotiation. I think everyone that works in a brand studio has had these conversations with clients, trying to get them to understand that what the audience wants to hear is probably as important, if not more important, than what you want to say. And so there's a bit of a balance there. And I think, I'm a firm believer in the value of true native. However, I think that, you know, you say, I make a distinction here. Can the same piece of content work across multiple channels and platforms? Maybe not. But the same story can work across multiple platforms and contents. And I think that is finding a narrative, a story that has the ability to be tailored and tweaked and optimized to different platforms. And that approach is, you know, potentially more efficient, because a lot of the hard work is story sourcing. It's finding the different ingredients, the voices, the settings, you know, the things that we used to sort of cook up a great story.
Yeah.
And then assembling those in a way that makes sense. Making it very clear, you know, the simplest of terms, a written article does not work on a podcasting platform because it needs to be taken in audio. But that means that when I create a story, if I capture audio, video, photos, text, you know, I have all those elements, then we can kind of mix and match. And I, you know, think of it like a salad bar. where pick and mix salad bar at the grocery store, and you have all of these ingredients here that you need to kind of put together a good meal. But depending on who walks up to the salad bar, you might put a little bit more of one ingredient and a little bit less of the other. Yeah. And so I think that as an agency that's not tied to a publisher, we need to think through, all right, if we want to do a native campaign, you know, we need to make sure that we've got the elements and bring the story as far as we can. But I have full respect that the brand agency, or the brand studio at a publisher is going to have, you know, a little bit more insight and need to kind of massage whatever story we bring to them. Mm. But I think it's very hard, and publishers are finding this, to do the sort of the A to Z from sourcing, reporting, creation on behalf of their clients and do that at scale. It's very, very resource intensive. Now, there's great work that's being done, certainly by a lot of brand studios, but it can be tricky, especially if a brand wants to work on competing channels, because all that great work that the brand studio has done is kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to work as a brand with another publisher, then I have to sort of do the whole process again. And now the final product is going to be truly, truly native.
Yeah.
But I might sit there and think, well, I just, you know, we just did the same story twice. Maybe that wasn't so efficient.
But on the other hand, I think that everybody that works with content in a structured way, even at the publishers, are used to taking that one story and creating it in different ways. Traditional publishers still publish on their own platforms, but they also distribute their content on Facebook. Now, obviously, the same piece of content need to be changed a little or a lot to fit into different environments. But I think, you know, most of people who are used to working with content are to some extent used to taking into account what kind of platform you're putting, you know, your piece of content on.
No, I think you're right. Absolutely. So it's a question of degrees, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to your 2014. You said you were asked to launch an actual studio at the local. Could you share with us a little bit about that process? I mean, what was the goal and vision for the studio to start out with?
Well, the studio was, as many things, sort of born out of necessity, if nothing else. I mean, we had, as I said, the local had been dabbling in sponsored content and found that there was a sustained interest from advertisers. And I think at the same time, we saw that our display revenues were dropping, and we recognized that we had, as a niche publisher for mobile professionals, you know, we had channels across 9 different countries in Europe doing news in English. And so we thought, you know, we can reach a very hard to reach audience. And if we know that we have the editorial capacity, the trust, that we can be a really valuable partner in helping brands tell their stories. And if we kind of have a more cohesive and robust offering, perhaps we can expand that part of the business. You know, I mean, the argument, you have a much different conversation with your advertisers. So I think the first step was, I had been at the company fairly long time compared to a lot of the other journalists, and I had been a bit curious about this development that had been taking place in parallel with my work in the news desk. And so when this opportunity came up and they sort of said, we want to move our advertising in this direction and do more sponsored content. And I mean, I kind of raised my hand expressing interest, and they said, that's great, because we really need to have someone who knows the voice of the local, who has the editorial experience to make this offer credible and palatable to advertisers. So I think, you know, first was making sure that we had the editorial capacity, and also moving me from the news desk. I left the news desk and, you know, sat in a different room.
So physically moving you.
Physically moved to the business side. So mm-hmm. I was sitting, instead of with journalists, I was sitting with salespeople. And that was a bit of a change, but it was useful for me to kind of immerse myself in that side of the business and learn a bit more about the sales process. I hadn't been involved in that at all, really, in the editorial side. And I think what I came to learn is how critical a good sales team is to making this work, because selling advertising in the traditional way, selling space, requires a very different conversation than selling a competency. You know, you're basically selling a partnership, and that means that the salespeople need to have a much different type of conversation and also manage expectations. The reality is the best native campaigns that I've been involved with have a client who's really hands-on. I mean, okay. Wants to be involved because there needs to be a dialogue. And, you know, there's a balance there. Sometimes clients can be too hands-on, but I find I'd rather have too much involvement than too little, because when the client just says, all right, I've paid you and you're on your way, there's a lot of freedom, but there's, you know, the reality is we don't work for those companies. We're an external partner, and having a sounding board and really an integrated approach is much more effective, because every decision you make, you can kind of get some buy-in and understand, all right, are we going in the right direction? Have these little negotiations, as opposed to coming 2 weeks later with a finished product and saying, well, this isn't at all what we wanted, and having to go back to the drawing board, which, you know, is very frustrating for everyone.
How did you get the salespeople to, I mean, not necessarily just on board, but you say they need different skill sets. Did you have to hire new people, or did you train the ones that you had, or how did you get them, you know, up to speed?
Yeah, it was a combination. There's always a lot of turnover in sales, but I think we were able to identify people that were existing there that seemed to understand that this was a different type of sales proposition. And I think I was, I don't know if I would call what I did sort of training, but maybe a bit of coaching. I mean, I was brought in to a lot of sales pitches early on, and we had a lot of back and forth and discussions about getting ready for these meetings and sort of making sure that we had enough creative ideas ahead of time. You know, and for just that, I mean, you know, when you're selling banners, you don't have to walk in with creative ideas. You have to walk in with it's a price negotiation and an exposure negotiation. But when you're selling native, it's a much different prospect. And I think the other thing is, in the early years, I think that the process was longer because we had to sell in native as a concept in many cases. There were a lot of advertisers who were not quite understanding why we were contacting them. I would call up sometimes and I get sent off to the media relations person, and I said, actually, no, I'm you know, I'm not calling from the news desk. Yes, I want to talk about stories, but I want to actually sit down with you and have you pay us to help you create your story and put it out to our readers. And so it took a while sometimes just to even find the right person on the other side.
So how did you convince them? What kind of selling points did you use?
Well, I think one of the big selling points for native is this, in our case, as a niche publisher, it's knowing that we had an audience that was very hard to reach. And the audience at the local is a really powerful and desirable audience, but it's quite diverse and spread out. So that was, I think, the biggest value proposition. And then for many, it was our editorial capacity.
Okay.
Being able to speak to this audience that we, you know, not only could we deliver that audience, but we knew how to speak to them in a way that a lot of our advertisers didn't, because in many cases they were, you know, if they're a Swedish company, sure, maybe they've got a global ambitions, but there are certain peculiarities with every audience that the local had some insights into that were not as obvious from the outside. So that, you know, we say it was competence and audience. I mean, those are the two things that we were selling.
Yeah. There's a lot of publishers out there building studios, or at least thinking about it. If you were to be commissioned to build a studio out of the publisher's house, how would you go about that? For example, what kind of people would you hire if you had the opportunity to hire five people?
Five people. Okay. All right.
So what kind of people would you hire?
Well, you would need to have an editor-in-chief / project manager / key account manager. I mean, I think the head of a studio has to wear all of those hats. And exactly how much of that client management falls into the studio versus the sales team is an open question. But whoever is in the studio, heading that studio, needs to be as much client oriented as audience oriented. And that's a challenging skill set. So I would have an editor, I would have a couple of writers or content producers, depending on the channel. I mean, someone who can also do podcasts and videos as well as be quite skilled with words. And then I would have at least part of, if not a full-time person, but a social media manager. Social media is a big part of any distribution strategy. And that's a big part of how you can help push, well, not only native content, but any content. So having someone to manage that part of things, and both from a listening point of view, what are people talking about, what's trending, but also how can we most effectively put the content we've created in front of the right audience and tweak the posts and the headlines and the tags so that we reach all of the different audiences we want to reach. And then the other part that I would have, and again, I'm not sure if it's full-time, but depends on the scale, but someone who is a sort of digital strategist, a data, you know, someone who is a Google Analytics and Google Data Studio genius, someone who can go in and look at, you know, read the tea leaves and all the numbers that are coming forward from content performance, channel performance, demographics, etc., and kind of help use that information both to help optimize distribution performance, but also to give clues about what kind of stories are the most effective and feeding that back into the sort of the idea generation part of it. But I used to call it was like a pop-up editorial desk. You know, so you have your editor and your journalists, but we have a seat at the table then for the client as well. And they're a part of that. It's really quite an integrated approach. And I think that's another part of the equation. And I think there's a debate to be had about how much of the proper sales should be sort of merged or a part of the studio itself. Because I think the studio kind of has to sell itself. In that sense, it is a bit like an agency where you are a consultant out trying to kind of help people understand how you can help them. And that is a bit of a sliding scale, I think, but something to consider when you're building up, I think, an operation. I think it's important to look at your existing sales structure and what kind of salespeople do you have, and making sure that there is some of them who are really sort of native specialists, if you will, and are really tuned into the operations of how an editorial operation works. So that's why if you're resource poor, you might want to have a journalist that has had some sales experience can go in and also meet with clients. The other way to look at it is you have salespeople that have had editorial experience, so they can really be a credible salesperson and promoter of content and all that it involves, and really get a feel for some of the challenges and roadblocks that come with it.
So you'd want to have salespeople that have, you know, either comes from the editorial side or the other way around, but someone who is specialist in native, as opposed to just having every salesperson also have native on their plate and agenda?
Well, it depends a bit on the channel and the setup, sure. But I think, you know, certainly in my experience at the local, I mean, we had most of our sales team didn't have editorial experience per se, but they were definitely, I mean, we had a very integrated relationship, and we made sure that they had everything that they knew. You know, we tried to kind of coach and help them be as effective as they could be. And that meant sometimes that we came into the meetings ourselves in different capacities. And sometimes we just kind of did a lot of preparation together before for sales meetings. And I think it's also quite personal. And you see also that the certain clients have relationships with the journalists that are writing the material on this, you know, because even there, you know, even if the journalist's role isn't sales and client management, you know, after the deal is done, it's that journalist who has most of the sort of day-to-day contact with that client. And so it was also really important for them to be aware of the client relationship aspect of their work. You know, they are the face of the studio on a sort of operational basis. So it's sometimes a journalist can help build a business by selling in ideas. And if the idea comes from the journalists, it might get a bit more credibility from the client than if it comes in from the salesperson. And that's why it's worth looking at that constellation. And, you know, it's hard to say from the outside what is the best operation. But so when you're selling a partnership, I think the closer that those partners can be to the client and be a part of that process, the more effective it is long term. Certainly, I think when it comes to renewals, say, oh, great, we know that you've done a great job, and we want to just keep doing what we've been doing. And you know, that's the sort of the holy grail is where this pop-up newsroom becomes permanent, if you will. And you actually have an integrated storytelling team where everyone is kind of tuned into the channel and the messaging, and you co-create together. And that's really rewarding, because then everyone's got buy-in and everyone is kind of pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen with every client. And that's also, you know, that's the way it is.
I was talking to the head of native advertising at SAP, Tim Clark, the other day, and they've been running a native project on SAP, the brand voice, where they have a blog on Forbes.com, and they've had it since 2011. Mm-hmm. So it's been running for 7 years consecutive now. It's mostly produced by SAP themselves, but just the fact that is really something where they can see the value, and they keep growing and they keep getting better. In terms of the salespeople, I think one crucial thing, if you have native specialists on your sales team, or you go the other way around, I think it's crucial for publishers to give them, whoever it is, an actual budget for native. You know, at the beginning, a lot of them just have kind of a, oh, you got that one, you know, that's a product you can sell as well, but they don't have a specific budget on it. And to most of them, you know, if they're used to selling traditional ads, it'll always be easier for them. And what they will do instinctively is just to sell, you know, 10 pages or whatever it is, other than going into something that is difficult and new and hard for them to explain. So I think it's pretty crucial, whatever direction you choose, that there is a budget that someone is responsible for that is dedicated to native.
No, I mean, native is it requires resources and it requires commitment. And I think the trick, certainly from, there needs to be a commitment from the publisher's side to say that we want to have this as another important revenue stream, and we're willing to invest to build up that capacity. At the same time, there needs to be I think learning how to help more clients see that value and understand why they should also make the investment in using native as a, you know, as one of the tools, and to really look at it differently than a traditional campaign. I mean, I think you hear people say, well, okay, it's still advertising at the end of the day. And I don't deny that it is, but I think it's important to step back and think about, well, what can advertising be? And instead of looking back, we should always look ahead. And as technology and the opportunities that exist evolve, I think it's fair to also, and necessary, that we, you know, reshape some of the conceptions that we have about what things are. I mean, this is maybe not a perfect analogy, but there was a time when all you did on a telephone was talk. And now, you know, very little time on the telephone is spent talking, but it's still a telephone. And so advertising need not be a static billboard somewhere. Advertising can be a much more immersive and flexible experience. And, you know, and this issue of semantics, I think, keeps coming up. Certainly in the that was one thing that struck me from the last year, was just how if you ask people what is native advertising, you get a lot of different answers. And you know, I think that's useful in that it shows that the breadth of thinking on the topic, but it's a bit frustrating because it becomes hard to sell if you say native advertising and you have in mind one thing and the client has in mind another thing. And so that's another part of the you know, those initial conversations, is kind of making sure that everyone's on the same page with what they're discussing.
Yeah. I'd like to go back and talk a little bit more about studios versus agencies. One of my good friends, Andrew Davis, who is now a keynote speaker in the States, used to run a content agency in the US about 5 years ago. He ended up selling the company. And the reason for that, he told me, was that he was afraid of the competition from the publishers. His point was that they're going to be able to do everything an agency can, but they can always add the audience that they have, which an agency can't. And at this year's Native Advertising Days, in just a couple of months, you're going to moderate a panel on that specific topic, you know, studios versus agencies. You've made the pivot the other way, going from a publisher to a content agency. How do you feel about the whole studio versus agency situation?
Well, you know, I'll be honest and say it wasn't something I thought about a whole lot until I made the switch myself. I think it's a discussion worth having, and that's why I'm really excited to be able to hold that discussion in Berlin in a couple of months, and I look forward to hearing lots of different perspectives. I expect that there are probably more and more people like me who are kind of in this revolving door, if you will, between publishers and agencies. You know, there's another revolving door between the editorial side and the client studio side. But I see, I mean, you can be a bit dramatic about it and call it a battle, and it's going to be a lot of tension. But I see it, you know, to be more frank, probably something of an evolution. As you said, I think there are clear advantages that brand studios have. I mean, and the biggest one is this direct access to this audience. I mean, they have their own channels, and that's right. Something that agencies don't have. And that gives them access to audience insights, to data, and kind of keeping their finger on the pulse in a way that you can't if you're not literally sitting with in a publishing house. Mm-hmm. But I can also turn it the other way from the agency perspective and say, well, but we're also free to work across multiple publishers and platforms in a way that a specific brand studio might not. And I the same way that I would get frustrated when I would see really good corporate content stuck in some corporate website, which I realized that no one visited. I said, man, but this content needs to be seen. And I kind of feel the same way now. I mean, why should a great piece of content have to be stuck on one publisher platform? So what agencies provide, though, is then an opportunity to work across multiple platforms. So they don't have access to the audience specifically or as tight, but they have perhaps access to different audiences. And so that's one area to where I think is interesting to discuss. Mm. I think the other tension that has existed for a while is this kind of scalability or division of labor. Telling stories really well is hard. It's yeah. costly. it requires a lot of investments. And increasingly, what people are, you know, advertisers want even more creative. I mean, a sponsored article in many cases doesn't cut it anymore. You yeah. know, you've got to have digital animation, and you've got to have, you know, drone videos and all kinds of other elements, which suddenly it's a much different animal that you're dealing with. Yeah. And I think publishers are struggling to scale studios to meet that demand. And I think, you know, looking ahead, there's still some things to shake out. And that's where I see this kind of agency studio. I don't see it as a winner or loser. There's going to be some studios that perhaps are able to evolve and become closer to agencies. I think, you know, New York Times T Brand Studio is really trying to reach that, and we'll see how that shakes out. Mm. I think in other cases, you'll see studios going back to basics and saying, you know, we need to stay focused on what we're really good at. We produce stories that are exactly like the stories that our editorial team is producing. And we can't try to be all things to all people.
Right.
And so where an agency fits into that, sort of an external content agency, I think for a smaller publisher, wouldn't it be nice if an agency just delivered you a story and you didn't have to worry about calling all these people, doing all these interviews, assuming that the agency has done a good job?
Yeah, and they know your audience.
Yeah, then your job as the brand studio becomes more of a fine-tuning. And, you know, I mean, making sure that it fits into the environment so that in terms of the amount of effort versus the amount that you can charge, I see that's a pretty good trade-off because you didn't have to spend all these weeks chasing down people and doing draft revisions with the client. Say you had a product that was 80 to 90% finished, mm-hmm. you kind of wrap it up, put a bow on it, but you can still take in a good chunk of change.
Yeah.
Whereas it may be that some of the bigger publishing houses that have multiple titles within them consolidate and have the ability to create what is in essence is, you know, a content agency dedicated to native content within that. And they might have the resources and capacity to see if they could even create content that yeah. would go outside those channels. So it's a shifting landscape, and you know, I don't know where it'll come out. There might be some new social media platform that pops up next year that changes the dynamic. Facebook might change their algorithm. I just saw now that the, you know, the European Union is voting on this this copyright redefinition, which could also really change a lot of the levers that are at our disposal between when it comes to distribution. It's distribution and audience versus story and creation. And those are the two things that I think go into any good native campaign, but exactly how much of the budgets go to which part of that and who does it is evolving.
What would your advice be to brands looking to choose the right partner? Because they'll be approached by both different kinds of studios and different kinds of agencies. So if you were to look for a good partner for your native campaign, and not talking about a specific studio or anything, but just what should you be looking for? What kind of questions should you be asking?
I mean, it's hard because there are, and I noticed this is certainly working at the local and both at Tail, when you have brands that are global versus local. Part of it also has to do with where are the decisions made about what communication ends up where. And so part of it is the distance that you have to travel. Do you have an agency based in London that's taking care of certain activities? Or does the local marketing director in Denmark or Sweden or for the Nordics, what kind of capacity do they have? Brand should look at first is how is our own communications set up, and how well integrated or not are our different parts. And then they ask themselves, are we looking at native from a campaign and marketing based approach? Are we looking at more from a strategic brand definition approach? Because if you're the former, and then I think an agency can be a useful partner, because they're going to have a little bit more time capacity to help with that whole strategic landscape and make sure that the brand's communications are working. But if the brand is a bit mature and has taken care of a lot of those decisions, it can be the key questions. What do you want to say, and who do you want to say it to, and why do you want to say it? I mean, those are the three key questions that I always need answers to in any of these, either at the local, here at Tail, or, can you answer those three questions on your own? Then I think as a brand studio, you can really get off the launch pad a lot quicker. And then you can start to get into the stories and the creation and then work on a distribution plan. Yeah. But if those three questions are a little harder to answer, I would say that an agency can be quite useful, because then you aren't sort of chasing campaigns for campaign's sake, and you have a better understanding of what, how it all fits together with your overall business strategy and broader communication goals.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I think if native is campaign driven, I mean, to sort of cook it down here, I would say get into a brand studio that can do quick turnaround and really give you some solid results about that campaign. If native is a part of a broader branding exercise, then it might be worth looking at an agency that can work with a few different publishing platforms and help shape that message a little bit more and see where native fits in.
It certainly is a very interesting discussion, the whole that the ecosystem is being turned upside down. And that's one of the things that you're going to be talking about on the panel at Native Advertising Days in November. So we're looking forward to that. But before I let you go, David, could you tell us briefly, what can we expect to see from Tail, in the next couple of months? What are you working on?
We have, I can say that Native is a part of almost every conversation that we're having with clients right now, and where it's going to land, I can't say, and I can't predict. But what we see more and more, and I think I said this earlier, is the need to help brands tell their stories by behaving a bit more like publishers. So in terms of concrete projects, part of that is helping them reorganize. So a lot of the work that we do really does get into strategy and looking at the overall communications landscape on behalf of our clients, is sort of setting up integrated newsrooms that are working on multiple channels, of which native is one. But it's also having a broader connection. How does native fit into what's being said on the website? How does it relate to what's going on in the PR and media relations, and how can we have those things work in synergy? And I think we at Tail have some really cool projects in the pipeline that I hope I can talk about in a concrete way by the time I show up in Berlin in November.
We're certainly going to be looking forward to that. David, thank you so much for taking time to be on the Native Advertising Powerhouse. I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are going to get a lot of good stuff out of what we've been talking about. So thank you for being on the show.
Great, thank you. And certainly if anyone wants to reach out directly, they can find me on Twitter or LinkedIn, and I'm happy to get more input and continue this conversation on a one-to-one basis, because as you said, there's a lot to discuss.
We'll be sure to put that in the show notes. Thank you, David.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And for our listeners, if you like what you've heard, please drop us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe. We're also now available on Pocket Casts and Stitcher. But whatever platform you prefer for listening, remember that you can also be notified each time we launch a new episode by signing up for our podcast newsletter at nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/podcast. And finally, if you want to learn more, please join us in Berlin for Native Advertising Days this November 6th through 8th. Visit nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/days for more information. That's all for now, folks. Next time, we'll have Carla Johnson, international keynote speaker, best-selling author, and principal at Type A Communication on the show. So make sure to be back for more insight on how to build a native advertising powerhouse.
That's it, you guys. Remember to subscribe to the Native Advertising Powerhouse podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud.